Hi, everyone, and thanks for joining the Sunstone Under the Banner of Heaven Watch Group live stream. We've all finally gotten through the 7 weeks of watching Under the Banner of Heaven unfurl on television, and I've heard all kinds of opinions that are playing out all over the map. And truthfully, I'm not sure what anybody was really expecting. Lindsay was the only one who knew in our office. So, of course, it's based on the book of the same name by John Krakauer. And when I looked at the book's Amazon page just a few hours ago, I saw that it had a 4.5 star rating, which is pretty dang good. And it's also currently a bestseller on Amazon. And then I went back into Sunstone's archives and I looked at the reviews of Krakauer's book when it first came out. They didn't seem terribly impressed with it, especially with the history that it presented. And so, as this show was coming out with the same name on it, we had Orthodox Mormons on one end and the church who were probably kind of worried about having the Lafferty murders broadcast to the world again and connected to the LDS church after all these years. I talked with my little sister the other day and I said, you know, it's about the Lafferty murders. And she's like, what? Some people didn't know about this. And on the other hand, we had the scholarly community that was really worried about, you know, sort of an unimpressive history that might be foisted on the masses. So everybody was a little on edge. We weren't quite sure what was going to happen. But the television series took a really interesting turn by being based on actual events. That's what the little thing at the beginning said. And so it's a story instead of being a documentary. It brought fiction and history together into an amalgam that sort of gave it the chance to be something of its own, kind of establish an identity apart from the book. So I wanted to bring together three historians to talk about this really interesting hybrid of history and fiction and how they think it worked out. So on the panel today, we have Barbara Jones Brown, Brian Buchanan, and Cheryl Bruno. And I really want to thank you guys for coming. Say hi.
Hello.
There we go. All right. These people are really nice. Just to let you know, they just got finished with MHA. And one of these people was in charge of MHA.
I have to say, I was helping my successor, Carrie Ann DeLoach. Oh. She needs the full credit. Sorry, I have to interrupt because I cannot take the full credit. She was the one who was behind me. I was there helping her.
I'm actually flattered that all of you would come because I'm sure all of you were there and were having the time of your life. And then you give me a little time. Thank you. So would you please briefly introduce yourselves? Let's go Barbara, Brian, and then Cheryl.
My name is Barbara Jones Brown, and as Stephen just mentioned, until this morning at about 10 a.m., I was executive director of the Mormon History Association.
You lost the mantle. I can see it's gone.
Do I look so much more relaxed?
You do. You look great.
It was a big job, a lot of work. I absolutely loved it. It was wonderful. I've been doing that for the last 4 years. But I am pleased that in March, I started as director of Signature Books Publishing as well. Before that, I was the content editor of a book that came out in 2008 titled Massacre at Mountain Meadows. And then after that was published, one of the authors of that book, Rick Turley, asked me to be his co-author in writing the sequel to that book, which we are so excited. We turned into Oxford University Press last month. That's a great relief to be. We've been working on Mount Meadows for 17 years together now. It was thrilling to turn that in. We're excited about it. It'll be titled Vengeance is Mine, The Massacre at Mountain Meadows and Its Aftermath.
I'm Brian Buchanan. I work at Benchmark Books in Salt Lake City. And you very likely recognize my voice as the co-host of the Sunstone Mormon History Podcast with Lindsay. So we've already been doing some episodes that'll be coming out that'll talk about each episode. So I'll come here tonight. And we'll talk some more about it.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Bruno. And this is interesting, but I have just been brought on to John Whitmer Books as the books manager. So we have lots of representation here tonight. John Whitmer Books, of course, focuses more on sort of the Eastern branches of the Restoration groups. I also just have a book coming out with Coford on Freemasonry and Mormonism, and I am an independent historian.
Thanks so much for joining me. So let's set up the discussion here. The Under the Banner of Heaven television series is three steps removed from the history that it's based on. So it's not a primary source. It's not a secondary source. Rather, it's a piece of fiction that uses primary and secondary sources to tell its story. So history plays an important, but also a complicated role in this story. And it's as a non-historian, it feels so complicated that I want to be able to sort of get us up to speed by making sure that everybody knows what it is we're even talking about when we talk about history. So my first question for all of you is, before primary sources, before secondary sources, before history books, what is history itself? What is the stuff that all of these sources are describing?
I just feel like history is an event that happens, whether anyone sees it or not, or writes about it or anything. It's just an event that happens.
And then I would just add that in terms, when we talk about history, we can't talk about what is truth, because history, when historians, when anyone interprets it, it's our interpretations of events, our best interpretation of it. So we can never say this is true. We can say, here's the facts that are documented as well as we know them. We can evaluate the sources that we use. It needs to be grounded in fact. It needs to be grounded in solid and thorough research of primary and secondary sources. And then we historians make their best interpretation of what happened based on that research and that documentation rather than speculation.
And for me, I see history kind of as a blend of science and art. So it involves finding things, then it also involves blending those things together. And you're almost acting as a detective, interrogating those sources that you have. Why were they created? When were they created? What's their purpose? How do they relate to the other sources? Do they have motives? Are they even aware of those motives? Those kind of things. So it's like I said, I think I see it as a blend of art and science.
To ask what is probably a silly question coming from a non-historian, if something happens and nobody is there to see it, it's still history. Is that what you're telling me? History can be unperceived.
It doesn't matter if anyone sees it or interprets it or anything, but then we go to the next step. The next step will be primary source. And when you get to a primary source, then you have interpretation. The person that's describing the event that happens only has a certain perspective of it, like Barbara was saying. And then when we get even farther, it's more of what Brian was saying, that, you know, you're writing about it and it's this blend. But when you start off at square one, whether anyone's there, the tree is fallen in the forest, whether anyone sees it or not. Right.
So there's history, the things that happened that may or may not have been perceived.
Mm-hmm, right.
That's history itself. And then we perceive it through primary sources.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So to use Cheryl's example, for example, let's say a tree falls in the forest and no one sees it. Well, people will come along later and observe that the tree fell. They can record what they noticed about the tree, where it fell, and so on and so forth. Those become primary sources. And so when you can access those as a historian, that's when you can say, a tree fell in the forest.
Those are the kinds of sources we're looking for, that we like to find when someone is actually there, someone's observing it, yet still they're only going to have their certain perspective. They will only see certain things. They will be standing at a certain place to observe the grassy knoll and someone else will be somewhere else. But we look for primary sources. We want to find the people that were actually there to observe what happened.
So yes, primary sources, the more that you have, the better. And the more perspectives you have, the better. And if you're being a good historian, you're getting every perspective and every viewpoint you can and sharing all of those views rather than just one view. Secondary sources are also very important because they can, rather than just having one person's point of view, they've gathered all these points of view and interpreted them and shared them. That's when the interpretation starts I think, is with secondary sources. So both are very important.
It seems to me that what we've been saying so far is that primary and secondary sources aren't necessarily pure revelation that came like light into the mind of humanity. Rather, it's people who have witnessed or have seen something or have inferred something, put it out there through their own point of view, and probably in a particular sort of situation. They tell us a piece of history, not just because it's a piece of history, but because it connects with something that is being talked about or going on. So they have a reason for telling it, and it's a story. And so each one of these things, primary and secondary sources, are driven by sort of the storytelling impulse. They don't tell us everything about a subject. They tell us something about the subject that will enlighten us about the particular thing that we're talking about. So when a historian says that something is historically accurate, what is it that they usually mean?
I do not like to use the word accurate at all when describing.
Okay.
Because as Barbara mentioned, we really can never be accurate. We can never tell exactly what happened. Even if we're there, we can't always be exactly accurate. We only see our perception of what happens.
Things can be well documented, well researched. You can triangulate different sources. Like if you have one source over here that says something, one source that never talked to this person observes something. And again, the more triangulation you get, the more certain you can be, okay, this is well documented. And so again, and then you use those facts, those things that you've gathered to create an interpretation, your best interpretation of history.
The amount of sources is very helpful. And if you have two sources, like you said, that, you know, one that hasn't talked to another. Also, if you have two sources that have kind of different varying motivations on the outcome that agree on something, that's also very important, because if they're, you know, at odds with each other otherwise, but agree on something that happened, that's a good way to focus in on, well, that seems most likely that that is what actually happened. It's almost in terms of plausibility, like this seems the most plausible way to describe what happened based on what we've got at our disposal.
I agree with Brian, what he said about history is a combination of art and science. Science can help us, archaeology and so forth can help us, forensics can help us understand things that happen. And there are certain things about that that are incontrovertible. So for example, Shannon Novak was a forensic anthropologist who studied the bones in a mass grave at the Mountain Meadows. Okay, so you cannot argue with that because we have these bones, right? And then she can say some of them died from bullet wounds directly to the head. She found that most of them were bludgeoned to death with rocks or some kind of blunt objects. So we know that that happened, right? She can also look at the and say whether they were male, female, ages, and so forth. But what that doesn't tell us is who did the killing, what the motivations were behind the killing, and so forth. So there are some things that can be absolutely established happened, but again, then the interpretation of motivations, who did it, so on and so forth, that's the work of the historian using historical sources.
It sounds to me like if you want to say something akin to historically accurate, what you're saying is this fits into the largest part of the current of discourse about this particular subject. Is that about right?
Yeah. I agree with Cheryl that like historically accurate is, you know, there's better ways to describe it. So I think it means that it engages all of the research, all of the recent scholarship in a field, and does its best to say, okay, these are the interpretations that are out there. But yeah, it needs to engage the most recent research.
And for me, the best historians give you the evidence that they've gathered. They give you the interpretations that are possible, but yet then they make a choice of which one is most compelling to them. And that's where they use their historian's art. Is they will interpret for you and tell which one makes the the most is most likely to be closest to what happened. Those are so much more readable too, histories, than just a dry 17 people lying in this spot. The stories are what make great history.
The other thing that probably makes it readable is when they're not absolutely married to a particular interpretation, insisting that this is the truth.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fiction can be a very powerful tool for exploring history and exploring truths. And so there is a lot that we can learn and engage through fiction in learning about and engaging history.
Let's use that segue. Let's talk about the fiction called Under the Banner of Heaven, the television series. We're heading into the based on actual events genre. So it's not pure history. It's not pure fiction. When somebody makes a story that is based on actual events, what is that person trying to do? Why did they choose this particular method of telling a story?
There's inspired by actual events, based on actual events, and then this is, you know, a documentary history, you know. I think when fiction writers, whether it's through screenplays, novels, so on and so forth, and they want to have it based in history, they're trying to take some contours of history and take it and kind of explore different ideas and things like that. It's also a way to engage more people. I like to write narrative history because I do feel like it is more engaging for people to get into a story and so forth.
At the end of the day, a story is entertainment. So that can be fun entertainment, more a compelling, moving, something to inspire curiosity, thought, exploration. I think that's probably the type of entertainment they chose to focus on is what can this lead us to think about?
In the Under the Banner of Heaven, there's several stories that emerge. One is Jeb the detective's faith crisis, which kind of drives the series. And Mormon history is an excellent way to talk about religion and faith crisis and what you do when, you know, what you've grown up with is falling down around your ears. So I'm glad that they chose this particular situation to explore that idea. But then there's also several other threads that come in to the story. And those are what happens when you have someone who gloms onto their religion, has a religious scrupulosity, just goes overboard on religion. And also, how can a religion be perceived as Mormonism is in so many different ways?
And by the way, I really should have said this at the beginning. Spoiler alert. I hope you've all already read it or seen it because we're probably going to ruin things for you. Sorry.
I was lucky enough to be asked to attend the premiere of the first two episodes. And my favorite part about that night was listening to Dustin Lance Black afterwards kind of talk about what you're saying, like what he wanted to explore with it and what he wanted to get at. For me, what really resonated with me was extremism and how extremism is dangerous. I mean, it's happening over and over again, and including right now in our society. You look at what happened on January 6th at our nation's capital. I never thought I'd witness something like that in my life. So there's a lot of extremes. There's extremism in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints among some of its members today. I think that's an important theme to explore. And it's something that I hope in my book on Vengeance is Mine, we do explore this theme of extremism and how it's dangerous and how we need to be careful of it and watch for it because it can lead to horrific ends.
It sounds to me like what you guys are saying is that the reason fiction would engage with history is because a fiction writer says, this is a particularly important part of what's going on right now. And this piece of history can help us to think about it in constructive ways. You're doing it to talk to people like right now, what's going on in the culture as it's unfolding right now. You don't write to people 50 years ago, right? Because who would read it and who would interact with it?
One of the other things he also talked about was how asking questions can be dangerous. Mm-hmm. And I guess this is on my mind because I just returned from the Mormon History Association conference. And one of the reasons I love MHA so much, and also Sunstone and John Whitmer Historical Association, is it's a safe place to come together as historians and lovers of history and ask the hard questions and talk about things. And so I think it's really important to have spaces like that where we can address hard questions and where it's not dangerous. Because I feel like when we do address these hard questions, it just enlightens us and is freeing in some ways.
I think another reason that they chose the format and the medium that they did is it allowed them to explore the idea of variation. So different kinds of Mormonisms, different kinds of violence. And I think that's part of the reason that the show is not perhaps having the impact with everyone the way they intended. This series captures the worst case scenario. And because of that, it's very easy for people to dismiss that as saying, well, I don't see that. But I think the way the show was structured was to show that there are gradations of violence and how that is unfortunately endemic to our society. And then what can be done about it?
That's a pretty interesting comment you just made, Brian. You said, and what can be done about it? Does the show address that?
Not so much. I mean, not so much in their own actions. I think by showing the paths that are taken, it's more of an invitation rather than a solution.
So it's sort of calling us on our own journey.
What to learn from history. I think probably all of us here love studying history because what we learn from it. And I feel in my own life, studying history helps me be a better person. It helps me be more aware of things that are out there, different viewpoints, different kinds of people, different experiences. I feel expands me as a human being.
Now that we've gotten to this point, let's get to the crux of why you folks are here, which is considering how we've constructed what history is and what it is that Dustin was trying to do with this piece of fiction that was based on true events. What is it that historians can usefully say about this show?
I wanted to talk a little bit about why I felt that this show was such a literary, I feel like, masterpiece, using history as and into literature. I have a few certain points that I saw. They've been complained about by some that they're not historically accurate, you know, and I want to talk about why that doesn't bother me, that they're not exact replicas of history. So the first one that I heard some buzz about was the show compares the Lafferty's to, they're like the Kennedys of Utah. And everyone's like, those aren't the Mormon Kennedys. So we know how the Mormon Kennedys are more like the Marriotts or the Huntsmans or you know, Romney's. Yeah, Eccles, yeah. So yeah. We would not describe as Mormons, we would not describe the Lafferty's as Mormon Kennedys. But the reason why I think this was so masterful is because in every ward, there are certain families who are, we call them like the 10 families, the 10 families that have all the kids to be in primary and young women's and young men's, and then they're always at events. They're always setting up chairs. These 10 families kind of run the ward. They go to every weenie roast. And I felt like I really aspired to be one of those 10 families when I had my 8 children and went to every event and held all these callings. And the ward looks at those people as being just a little bit more, I don't know what the word is, but I know I felt a certain pride in being one of those 10 families. And I think that what that phrase, the Kennedys, the Lafferty's, were one of these 10 families in the ward, or one of these really devout families. And how better to say that than, oh, they were the Kennedys of, maybe not Utah, but the Kennedys of their ward, gives us kind of the sense, gives someone who's not a Mormon that sense of what kind of a family they were. You know, they are one of these families that is, out in the field with their all of their children and grandchildren surrounding them. And, you know, that simple phrase, while not historically accurate, gives a flavor of what the filmmakers wanted it to give. And so it was well used.
I thought that particular phrase you mentioned is a good example, because it was a device and it was used in various ways. So the first time you see it is when Pyrie is talking to Taba, and he's reminding him that he, Pyrie, is part of this fabric that Taba is not part of. He knows, he's heard of the Lafferty's. He's part of the scene. The other time it's used is when Brenda's talking to her father, and she's trying to pump up Alan to show that he's not weird. They're an important family. So it's used for very specific purposes.
I'm going to disagree a little bit with my panelists, and because I think that, and that's what the purpose is, right? To have different viewpoints here. I agree with Cheryl's view, like the use of that term was to show, okay, these are like, you know, mainstream leading families in the ward and so forth. And certainly Ron Lafferty, he had been bishop and so forth. He and Diana were kind of a predominant family in the ward. I guess I think calling them the Kennedys, though, made them, to me, sound like they're the most powerful, like the Kennedys were the power family of Massachusetts, right? So calling them the Kennedys makes it sound like the Lafferty's were the power family in Utah, when in fact, especially the brothers, as they start leaving, Ron eventually follows them, but they were very fringy folks in Utah. That was a concern I had. I didn't feel like that was an accurate representation, but again, that's my interpretation of watching the show.
Right. And I feel that some of these things I'm going to mention, I would agree they are not accurate representations. And I feel that maybe the filmmakers even knew that they weren't accurate, but are using them as, like Brian said, as a device. So what is he trying to get across? So another example I have is when they had Joseph Smith being killed at Carthage Jail. Many people have talked about how it's not historically accurate. It absolutely is not. I, in fact, am very triggered by the way that they portrayed that event. However, it shows something that I don't know that they would have been able to do without doing it that way. After Joseph Smith is killed, we have a succession struggle between several different groups. We have people jockeying for power, and it would be very, very difficult to show. So instead, they chose to use this device of having Brigham Young, is it John Taylor and Willard Richards, were they shown in there too, be the ones that actually murdered Joseph Smith. However, that did not happen. That is not historically accurate. But when you use it in the film this way, people who are not familiar with Mormonism can sort of see the power struggle that then went on between the different factions of the church. So I just thought it was actually an interesting way to do that, although very horrifying to me as a historian, because I do not believe that that Brigham Young had anything to do with the murder of Joseph Smith. However, then Brigham Young is involved right after he died, is involved in kind of jockeying for power. And so this sort of gives that feeling without having to go into all these little details of what happened.
There's no way Brigham Young was involved in the murder of Joseph Smith. He was in a different state. He adored Joseph and believed him to be his prophet. Absolutely. Afterwards, he got involved in the secession crisis. And as the leader of the 12 apostles said, we are the ones that have the power and control of the church going forward. But I will say this, I learned. So that was, I tweeted and I said, has anyone ever heard of this? I'm like, I'm a little bit confused where this came from. And people started responding. So I learned something, because people started saying that these theories that Brigham Young was involved in the murder of Joseph Smith evolved later by people who wanted to deny that Joseph Smith instituted polygamy. And I said, what? So they wanted to say that Brigham Young was the one who instituted polygamy, which is complete falsehood, but that he was the one who wanted to institute it. And so Joseph opposed him. And so he had Joseph murdered so he could practice polygamy and start this. So it was fascinating to learn that. And it was because of this fictional representation that I learned something new. My only concern is most of our viewers who are going to watch this, whether it says based on history at the beginning or not, most of them who watch it are going to think, oh, that's what happened. And as historians, then it's like, okay, we have to do work again to, you know, keep the historical record out there for people. So
yeah, absolutely. There's that concern, Barbara. But then again, I watched a show called Unorthodox. It was about a woman escaping from a Hasidic Jew.
Yes, that was so good.
Yes. She was escaping from a very repressive Hasidic Jewish environment. And that to me was fascinating because watching that as a Mormon, I do not know much about this particular faith tradition that they were talking about. Yet as a viewer, I saw it as a fictional story. And while I felt I was learning a bit about the Hasidic Jews, I did not for any amount of time believe that it accurately portrayed, you know, it was just one sort of iteration of it. And so I wouldn't have taken any of those events in that show to be historic. I think we're very worried as Mormons that people are going to get the wrong impression. I give them the benefit of the doubt. I think they realize it's fiction, as I did when I was watching this other show. They realize it's fiction.
I will just say, I cannot tell you how many texts I've received after episode 7 asking, did this really happen? This really, I mean, multiple texts. And I do think, Cheryl, you're coming at it as a very highly educated historian and viewer. And so because you have that lens, you're able to discriminate between, okay, this is probably just fiction and this is fact. But I think a lot of viewers who aren't trained in history and historical methods as you are and educated in those fields do come to watch a show like this and they do accept it as fact. And hopefully this miniseries encourages people to learn more about the history, mm-hmm. read some books and so forth and just continue to learn more.
What I really enjoyed doing, and perhaps it's just because I'm a historian and I like to think that other people do this too, is to see where there's the discrepancies to think, well, why? Why did they depart from the history on this? And there's always, I feel like a really good, cool reason why they do this. I loved the Mount Meadow sequence because number one, it showed that there were different ways of looking at Mount Meadows. We don't have many accounts, but the accounts that we do have show Mount Meadows very differently. The show started right out showing Mount Meadows in two different ways. And then when Taba was talking about how the Paiutes viewed it, there were also within that little segment, several different ways of looking at it. So that was fascinating to me, even though it was not strictly historical. But for me, it was really a cool way of doing it with the two different ways of looking at Mount Meadows.
It's so important when we're engaging history to engage all of the different points of view and share them. So I did appreciate that. This is my concern, though, is I don't know if y'all read the New York Times article in which Krakauer and Black talked to the New York Times, but Krakauer says this is absolutely historically accurate. And so I agree with you. They're not under an obligation to say this isn't, you know, because they do say it's based on, but then when they're telling the media, this is absolutely historically accurate. That's where it can be misleading and people get confused.
Couple thoughts on the historical flashback element of this story. While that structure does mirror what the book did, I think there was a great difference in how the show used those. And to me, I thought that the main point of those was to show how this thread of religious persecution had been woven within the minds of the Lafferty's. And mm-hmm. I think it's important to remember that, and it's always dangerous to say fundamentalist think, fundamentalist believe, because that's obviously an incredibly broad brush. But generally speaking, a fundamentalist mindset will see history in a different way than, say, academic history will. And so the way that these events were portrayed mirrored how they were seen by the Lafferty's. And I think that's an important distinction to remember, is they weren't necessarily trying to depict how the events actually happened, in quotes, but to show how they were perceived.
And also, I wish that they had brought that out a little bit more, that the flashbacks were more of coming from the Lafferty's mind rather than, because you can very much get the idea that they're just flashbacks of history. But I agree. I feel like they were flashbacks of the Lafferty's mindset of what history was.
That persecution narrative comes out again and again in the sources of folks who were Latter-day Saint, of folks who are any stripe of Mormon, if you will, that persecution narrative. And it is certainly there with the Mountain Meadows, and it's certainly there with the Lafferty's. And so I thought that the show did a great job of pulling out that theme.
So you guys brought up a very interesting question. You talked about how you got a lot of texts after the Brigham may have helped to murder Joseph Smith type of thing. And Cheryl is absolutely right that it was a great way of establishing a narrative element. In fact, the phrase lying for the Lord came to me because, you know, the Mormons used to lie for the Lord in order to progress the kingdom. And we're sort of lying for the narrative here. We're saying, well, this happened, which gives us so much more momentum to keep this particular part of the narrative going. And it works so well. Mm-hmm. But it brings up the point, especially when you're talking about people who aren't trained in history, who aren't trained in narrative, who would be taking anything they see on TV that's so well produced as gospel truth. Oh, that's really what happened. And now there's millions of people who think that Brigham Young helped to murder Joseph Smith. So what I'm wondering is there an ethics of fictionalizing history, especially for such a large audience?
I think, again, we've talked about, you know, the usefulness of using fiction in sharing history. I just think there's an obligation, though, to be forthcoming about that. And again, it does say based on true events at the beginning, but I think it needs to be stated more clearly. And again, when I see quotes like I saw in the New York Times article, that was discouraging for me. But and let's face it, there's always a crowd. Like, you could go and watch a movie that's complete fiction and people will still think, oh, that really happened. So you can't entirely avoid that. But I just think the key is disclosing that and being forthcoming of that up front.
I have one more little incident that I think is very illustrative of this point that we've been talking about. And that is, Jeb is in the police station interrogating one of the Lafferty brothers, and a general authority comes into his place of work and uses his ecclesiastical authority to pressure Jeb. And of course, this would never happen. However, I think it was a brilliant way to show the influence of authorities of the church on the members, because I have felt pressured many times in my life, in my work life, in not only in my spiritual life, but in my family life, in my work life. I have felt pressured from the church and from individuals or from leaders. I think it was a brilliant way to show this feeling that we get as Mormons, that we need to fall in line, that we need to follow our leadership, or that we need to be good representatives of the church at all times.
Yeah, I agree with you, Cheryl. I'm currently reading D. Michael Quinn's memoir that his children found on his computer after he died. And I'm reading what he went through in the 80s, and everything you're talking about was happening. I think the way they did it, to me, it was just so over the top. It was just like, oh, come on. Whereas if it had been like being called into a bishop's office and read a letter, you know what I mean? That is how it happened. You know what I mean? So yes, bring out those themes, show that this happens and happened absolutely, especially in the 80s and 90s, would make it more believable and more compelling for me because it was so over top. I mean, this general authority walks into a prisoner's cell, right? Isn't Alan in a cell or
interrogation room or something?
Yeah. And I thought it was so over the top that it was hard to just focus on that message that was being shared. So if it was like absolutely done, but done in a way that was more realistic of how it actually is done,
but
it would be
if we get more realistic, we don't get the huge weight feeling of, you know, that we do as members, that we have this.
It sounds to me, Cheryl, like you're saying, a lot of the things that when Mormons saw it, we said, that's over the top, that wouldn't happen. those were meant to be read as metaphors for how things in the church feel. It wasn't supposed to represent them literally, but sort of on an emotional level. It was emotional truth.
That's how it struck me, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, historical fiction is fiction still. And again, you have to remember that in creating the series, you only have so much time. And Lindsay's talked about how Lance really wanted more episodes and more time to be able to do just those kinds of things that we've been talking about that may have made some things a little clearer, but you do have limits. So you can only do so much in that amount of time. And so some of these things, these specific examples we've talked about were telescoping shortcuts, right? And as a result, sometimes those things may seem over the top. What I have found interesting, and Lindsay will explore some of these specifics in the other episodes we do, is some of the things that seem over the top are things that did actually happen and might be surprising to people. So I would say stay tuned.
Yeah, I think I'm on the edge of my seat now. It almost sounds like they should have put one more thing up in the opening credits, which is, if there be faults, they be the faults of men.
Yeah, and I would just agree with Brian. So at MHA 2021 last year, we had a panel that included the producers and the talking heads of Murder Among the Mormons. And so we had Tyler Meesom and Jared Hess and several of those who were interviewed. One of the questions I asked was, you wanted six episodes, you got three. If you'd had six, what more would you have included? And Jared said, I would have gone into like Lucy Mack Smith and just all these details. Yeah, I think as historians, we always want more, right? But there are limits in time and page counts. When you're writing a book, you have a limited number of page counts. So it is like, it is an art and it takes a lot of thought and effort to think, okay, what is the crux of the matter? What do we need to include so that the message gets across? But yeah, there are always limits.
And so writing on that, we have seen that there are a lot of inaccuracies and a lot of things that sort of set Mormon history back in the eyes of the world. But were those things, in your humble opinion, worth what the story was able to get across?
I would say yes.
Tell me why.
I would say yes. One is just, I feel that they got across something that is more of a feeling than an actual event. And so they set these up very, I thought, very, very skillfully. Another thing is, let me just talk a little bit about what I view as sort of the theme that runs through the show is Jeb's faith crisis. I have seen a lot of people identify with this faith crisis in a major way. And I have not seen anyone say, oh, that's not historically accurate. However, I, on the other hand, feel that that's one of the historical inaccuracies because I'm maybe a little bit older than most of the people watching the show and remember quite vividly the Lafferty murders. And I remember the times in the 80s, I was a 25-year-old young mother. And when I think of faith crisis in the 80s, faith crisis in the 80s did not manifest the same way that faith crisis does today. And you have in this film, you have a modern faith crisis, which really strikes a lot of people and which is awesome. And I wouldn't ask them to change it at all because it was well, well done. However, it's an anachronism because that's not how people lost their faith in the 80s. I do not wish that the producers had portrayed a 1980s faith crisis. It would not have fit. It was worth using a bit of presentism, which I really frown upon as a historian. In the art, I think it was worth using that.
Yeah. So as a historian of the massacre, I was seeing its portrayal and I was seeing, okay, in my mind, I was like, you know, just kind of going through all the things that didn't happen that weren't accurate, but it nailed it. I cried again when I watched it. It nailed the horror and the horrific nature of that atrocity, and that feeling came out. And that's fantastic, because it's fantastic in that we need to never forget, again, the extremism and what happened. And so I love that it made me feel the horror again, even though I've gone through the sources again and again and again and written about it so many times. And I felt the horror of the murder of Brenda and Erica. That was fantastic. I don't want to say fantastic, the crime, but it was so poignant and strong for me, those portrayals, whether or not they were exactly accurate or not, that they nailed that.
For me, as I've been watching how people have interacted with the series and responded to it, it seems like it was worth it. They were having to address a lot of big ideas. How did the Lafferty's get to where they got? How did that then lead them to justify what they did? And again, like I mentioned earlier, I hope that by using the worst case scenario, it doesn't allow for a loophole to say, well, as long as I'm not killing my sister-in-law, this, I don't have to really think about this, right? Because there are so many forms of domestic violence that are not that graphic, but are no less harmful and traumatic. And so if the course that led Ron, Dan Lafferty, to a lesser extent, the other brothers and the other members of the School of the Prophets to that, that is a course that someone else is on that's leading to a non-murderous violent situation, then that's a problem too. And so I feel like the way that history was employed in this hopefully doesn't detract from addressing those kinds of issues.
It's a cautionary tale for all of us today about where things can go if we allow ourselves to engage in extremism, the path that it can go. So I loved that about the series, is that it is a cautionary tale.
And if there's one thing in this world that's very Mormon, it's cautionary tales. Eat them with spoons. So it sounds to me like, despite the drawbacks, this particular panel feels like the emotional truth that got through was worth the journey and worth, I don't know, the collateral damage. We got something better out of it than we lost.
I don't know if I would judge it one way or the other, you know, like, it was worth it this, that, or the other. But I loved how you use that term, emotional truth, because I think when we talk about truth, there can be emotional truth. There is truth in our feelings, right? And so, yeah, I think that was fantastic. I just think this, and Cheryl and I disagree with it, but that's okay, because we're historians, because we love to disagree on topics, right? That's what we do in our profession. But I think that same message could have been conveyed with more grounding in more recent sources and scholarship.
That point is well taken. And I also have another a real quick example for what you just said, Barbara. I am going to talk about the temple scene where they do portray many aspects of the temple, which are more or less accurate. There are, you know, a few tiny, small differences. And I'm a little uncomfortable with the temple scene because I'm a temple going a member of the church. However, when my real problem with it was, is they didn't portray any of the beauty, or not much of the beauty of the temple ceremony. And this is possible to do while still portraying what they wanted to show, which I think they needed to show. For example, there was also a temple scene in the series Big Love, and that temple scene also showed some of the violence in the temple that's left in some of the temple ritual, but it had this beautiful music that was playing back behind it, and it gave you just a feeling of beauty and sort of the feeling I get when I go to the temple. So it did bring in some of that beauty with some of their lighting. And I was wishing that I didn't feel any of that in this temple scene. That I really felt it could have also brought in a bit more of what some of the faithful members see in temple ceremonies too.
The temple parts that were most interesting to me where the little, I don't know what you call them, just the little cuts where you see various members of the cast in the temple room, and it's obvious that they're wrestling with something. And I thought, that is the most interesting and probably weightiest part of what temples mean to Mormons. You go into the temple and you bring your weight inside of it. You wrestle before the Lord. And we got to see everybody in the temples. The Lafferty's were there. Brenda was there. Jeb was there. The creators of the show were trying to talk to people now. And in a way, they did a really good job. And I'm grateful for a lot of those good things that came along. And who knows, maybe someday in the future, somebody else will be able to pour tens of millions of dollars into telling a 7-hour Mormon story. This hasn't happened in decades.
Yes, I applaud them. I applaud them for the fabulous work they did.
For me, seeing Andrew Garfield be a Mormon was worth everything.
Yeah, I was really impressed. I was reading, I can't remember where I read this article, but it was describing the production team and everything they did to make the scene of the martyrdom as accurate as possible based on history, and the steps and the work that they went to make that accurate and, you know, try and get everything right. I was blown away with what they did with the production on that.
And isn't it interesting that it would be a bunch of, you know, mostly non-Mormons who put that work in? I don't think that work has been put in by any Mormon or even official church media sources. So in a way, we received quite an interesting gift from, you know, the outside world. Well, I'm going to wrap this up. Thank you all so much for taking time out, especially after such a busy weekend. And since we were talking about the Mormon History Association conference, the Sunstone Symposium is coming up as well. It's on the last weekend of July, and it's going to be really interesting. We're going to have a lot of tracks or sessions on Under the Banner of Heaven, including having members of the cast and the crew to come and talk with us. One of them is even going to sing to us. So it's going to be good, I promise. So go to sunstone.org/registration to register. And if you've been keeping an eye on the Watch Group Facebook page, you will find a secret code that will give you a discount. So go and look for that, and then you'll be able to get it for less money. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll catch you later.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.